like Jimmy, I'm also in a school that you might not think about when you think about information retrieval. I'm in the School of Information and Library Science. And I'll tell you a little bit more in a second about why people in these schools are interested in IR problems. The other thing that I want to tell you about my talk is that I'm going to talk a lot about human beings. And we haven't talked too much about human beings so far this week. Mostly we've heard a few people mention users, and the users did this, and we've talked about annotators and things like this. But I'm actually going to talk about people who are using these systems. My discussion of these people is going to be at a very specific level. So we heard a couple of days ago from Mark, who was sort of giving a bird's eye view of what users were doing online. But this is actually sort of zooming in to those individual users and looking at things like, well, what are they doing? Why are they doing it? What are they trying to accomplish? Just a little bit of background on myself. I sort of am from what you would call a fish scale model of education. I have a lot of studies in psychology. I have a graduate certificate in cognitive science. I also studied information retrieval and information science at Rutgers University. So I sort of have a broad background that sort of looks at information retrieval and human-computer interaction. So that's sort of my perspective. So I just wanted to start off with a little bit of background. So we've heard this IR a lot, and I know for some of you, you'll yawn at this, but IR, of course, is information retrieval. And what I wanted to tell you about is that in information retrieval, the area in particular, people who are usually in computer science schools or library and information science schools work on IR-related problems. And one reason for this is historically, when information retrieval first started to develop, libraries actually were good places where there were lots of documents, there were lots of people who had needs to find documents in large collections. And so there's a sort of natural relationship between these two areas that may at first seem to you not to be really related, but they are related. And if you're at an institution where you do have a School of Information and Library Science, I encourage you to seek out those people, because you might find some people who know about some of the things you're going to hear about in this talk, but also some of the things you've heard about in some of the other talks this week. So where can I find the most recent work in IR? I just wanted to tell you, too, you've heard this term SIGIR, which is probably the most important thing to know if you're looking for publications in information retrieval and wanted to catch up on what's the latest, greatest. This is the conference of a special interest group from the ACM, the Association for Computing Machinery. So that's a good place to find some of the most recent work on IR. And information retrieval, I would say, if I had to sort of peg it down, there's a person named Calvin Moores who was attributed to coining this term information retrieval. I think it was in the 50s, but I can't nail it down exactly. The SIGIR conference has been going on for about 30 years, and so people in this area have been working on problems related to search, indexing, and retrieval, and how human beings interact and try to find information for quite some time, longer than our search engine counterparts, of course. But of course, the good thing about search engines is that it makes it very easy for me to explain to my relatives what I do, because they can identify with that. And then I wanted to tell you just a little bit about Trek. I know everybody's probably on their seats. They've been waiting to hear about Trek all week. You've heard everybody talk about Trek this and Trek that. And so I thought what I would do is just give you a little background information on Trek, because it's really sort of a core thing in information retrieval. And if you're not really familiar with how it works and this idea of collections and corpuses and relevance assessments, then this is a really good stuff to know if you're just thinking about getting into the area. So it's not bad, although these people are probably dressed better than the people that actually attend the Trek conference. But what Trek is it's actually a workshop series that's been going on now for quite some time, and it's sponsored by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And basically what it is the Information Retrieval System Bake Off. It happens once a year, and all participants bring together their systems. They work on common problems, and then they get together and see who does best. And so it's sort of a competition, although of course they say, well, it's not really a competition, but people are keenly interested to see what the performances of other systems are and how well they did sort of in the entire collection of systems that are being evaluated at Trek. And anyone can participate in Trek. There is an annual cycle, and usually the call for participation goes out in February. I think, February or March. We're coming to the end of the cycle right now. The conference is typically in November, so if you're interested in getting involved, this is a good time to do it. And the idea here is just to build infrastructure. So we've heard a lot about collections and having people annotate collections, determining what's relevant and not relevant. The idea here is that let's come together and build some community resources like large corpora of data, relevance assessments, topics. Let's give people the tools so that they can do retrieval experiments and not have to worry about where these things are going to come from. The other thing that TREC does is develop a lot of the evaluation measures that we use in IR. So you've heard about some of the ones Karen told us about, precision and recall. You've heard about MAP. And some of these other kind of measures. So a lot of the sort of de facto measures come out of TREC as well. And then the other thing to note about TREC is that it's actually comprised of lots of different tracks. So you talk about TREC tracks. And tracks are focused on different kinds of things. And so some examples are question answering, which a lot of sort of the most well-known question answering people are here, which is pretty exciting, Bonnie. Some of the people talking tomorrow, as well as the person we heard from IBM. And then you can imagine something like filtering. There's a track this year and last year on blogs, so they sort of expanded to look at different kinds of things. This is a table that I took from a book, which is, I'll give you the reference for the book in just a second. It's a really excellent book for catching up on what's going on at TREC and what's been done. TREC, you can see, started in 1992 up here, and these are each of the years that it's occurred. The book was published in 2005, so that's why it stops about at 2003. And then you can see all of the different tracks that have happened. And you can see how each track suggests a different kind of focus. So we have novelty, we have video, web, QA, cross-language. And then you can also see these numbers here represent how many people participated in each of these tracks for each of these years. So you can also get an idea that the speech track, for instance, ran for 4 years. NLP ran for 2 years, and it sort of got subsumed probably into other things, or possibly spun off and made its own government funding workshop. So that just gives you a sort of bird's eye view of what's been done at TREC. So the important thing to know about TREC is that TREC actually consists of collections, and all tracks have to have some kind of collection that they're dealing with. And the collections are made up of three things: a corpus, which is typically newswire. And so Bonnie told us a little bit about these differences we saw in newswire performance versus web performance. And some people actually would argue that IR stuff is overtrained to newswire. And so that may be why you see that, because so many people working in IR have worked on systems that are designed to deal with and perform well with newswire text. So there is this issue that maybe it's overtrained a little bit. There's also a set of information needs, and these are called topics. And I have an example here. You can see what this looks like. So this is just a topic, has a title, a description, and a narrative. And these things are actually created usually by retired CIA agents. They come in, they make up these topics, and then later on they actually will do the evaluations on the documents that are returned. So that's what that looks like. Usually each collection has 50 topics associated with it, although there are some differences in the numbers. For instance, the QA, this CIQA track that Jimmy mentioned had 30 topics this year and last year as well. And then finally, there's a set of relevance judgments. So these people who make up these information needs or have these information needs actually sit in a room for long, long, long periods of time and evaluate documents that have been returned and rate them as relevant or not relevant. And so it's a binary relevance, and it's thought to be topical relevance or subject relevance.
What do you know when you're entering TREC? Do you know the corpus but not the topics? Or?
That's a good question. So usually you know ahead of time what the corpus is going to be. The TREC makes a decision about that. The topics they don't release until sort of right before you're supposed to do your experimental retrieval, your first baseline, what's called a baseline run. And you're not supposed to look at these topics at all. So you sort of, it's a sort of a faith pledge that you will not look at these topics, that you may use previous data and previous topics to train your system. But when you get those topics, you don't even look at them. You just do whatever. You process them the way you've already decided you're going to process them, and then do retrieval. So that's sort of implied in agreeing to do TREC. So each track also adopts particular evaluation measures, and again, lots of evaluation measures have been developed as part of TREC, and the people at NIST who coordinate TREC are really good at coming up with evaluation measures. But we looked at precision and recall, and there's actually something called the F measure, which is a combination of precision and recall. So in general, it's known that precision and recall are inversely related to one another. Now, this doesn't happen in all cases, and I'll show you a case in just a second. But in general, that's how it is. If you want to have more precision in your search results, then you're probably not going to retrieve as many relevant documents. If you want to retrieve all of the relevant documents, then you're probably not going to have as precise search results. So this is sort of a general finding in IR. And what the F measure does is allow you to combine these two measures together and actually weight one of them. So if you know that you're more interested in precision, then you can put a higher weight on getting the precision measure right. Or if you want to weight recall, you can do it that way. Now, the other measure, and one of the measures I'm going to show you in some of the research that I've done, so I want to tell you about it here, is something called average precision. And I think Jimmy mentioned this in some of his slides. Average precision, and then something called mean average precision, also called MAP. Now, when TREC assessments are done, and when people submit experimental runs, typically they're submitting the top 1,000 documents. And so you can think, well, no human being is going to look through 1,000 documents, unless they're a TREC assessor. But no other human being is going to look through 1,000 documents, probably. So these measures have been developed with the idea that there are going to be 1,000 retrieved documents, and that's going to be your base. These measures also, in fact, MAP in particular, is a measure that's what's called a run-level statistic. And by run-level, I mean that you take all 50 topics and you average your performance over all 50 topics. This measure here that I'll show you is actually a measure that just looks at the topic and the results for that particular topic. So this is sort of, that's why it's called, it's an average of an average. So I have to confess that I do not know how to use animation in PowerPoint, which is probably a good thing. But here I finally said, oh, here's the instance when I really need to use it, but I couldn't figure out how to use it. So you're going to see the sort of the end point before I actually get there myself. But if you imagine, and this is what I want to use to demonstrate AP and also sort of the shortcomings of just precision and recall measures in this instance. If you imagine these are two lists of documents that have been retrieved in response to a single query, and that these are 10 documents that have been retrieved, and this represents the rank position. The R represents relevant, and the NR represents non-relevant. If we ignore this for a minute, because this is the animation part, if you just looked at these two lists, you would probably say, I'd rather have this one over this one. But if you knew ahead of time that there were only 5 relevant documents in the collection for this topic, and you computed precision, which is the number retrieved relevant over the total number retrieved, so that's 5/10, and you computed recall, which is the number of relevant documents you retrieved over all the number of relevant documents in the collection, then these two lists would be the exact same on those measures. There'd be no difference. And so, again, clearly as humans, we can say, well, I'd rather have this one than that one, so I know there's a difference. So what average precision does is actually computes precision at each position where a relevant document has been retrieved. And so here I've just written that out, and then you see this 1 to 5, and then you take the average of that. So there are 5 relevant documents, that's my base, and then I just add those together. Over here you see that if I compute precision down here, then I get 1/6, 2/7, etc. And then if I take the average there, I get this value. So there you can see that there is in fact a difference between these two lists. And actually this is a mistake. These should all be ones. I can't blame that on the animation. That's actually 10, but anyway. Yeah, so that should all be 10. So even the most basic math I just screwed up, so I'm really embarrassed, but anyway, this is the thing to pay attention to. And so what mean average precision is, if you imagine this happened for one particular topic, it would be taking like 50 topics and averaging these values over 50.
So there, if you compared the left-hand list to the right-hand one that had all relevant documents, you would get one for both of them, but you clearly prefer the
actually what would happen is, when I said that we assume that there are only 5 relevant documents in the entire collection, that's our base.
Yeah.
And so if there were actually 10 relevant documents in the entire collection, our denominator down here would be 10. And so we wouldn't end up with such a great score. So essentially what happens is you're supposed to add a 0 for every relevant document not retrieved when you're doing the computation, but that just ends up, you know, not really adding anything at all to the value. So that's what I wanted to tell you about TREC, and hopefully, again, that sort of makes some things a little clearer to you. And here are a couple of references. This is a really excellent book, again, for anybody who's interested in learning more about TREC. I highly recommend it. Now back to what I'm going to talk about, personalization. So personalization is this process where we try to go beyond one-size-fits-all retrieval. And the common example is if, you know, two people type in the query Jaguar, then those two people may actually be meaning something else. One person may be talking about the car, the other person may be talking about the animal. And so the idea behind personalization is to figure out ways of collecting information about the person so that you can do the disambiguation in that example. So when you know person A, who already has a background and studies animals, types in Jaguar, you know that the chances of them being interested in documents about the animal are higher than perhaps documents that discuss the car. So that's sort of the idea behind personalization. And personalization is sort of interesting because this is sort of, it's a very popular topic right now. And of course, you know, I always take time to reflect in the United States in particular how everything is all about me. You know, we have the iPhone and the iBook, and everything seems to be centered towards the individual. So personalization is sort of no surprise that that's here as well. But it's been around for quite some time, and there's this person called Hans-Pierre Lune, who was actually a scientist at IBM. He was working to try to figure out ways of getting documents from the library to the scientist. And he came up with this idea of selective dissemination of information. So he's sort of the first person to do this idea of filtering. And so what would happen is you would try to figure out basically a text representation of what a person's particular interests were, and then use that representation to select documents or filter documents from an incoming stream of new documents. So it's been around for a while. And this idea of profiles, and this word's also called user model, and there's a whole body of literature on user modeling. Basically, these things are used to store data that's about the user and then represent their interests. So it's a model of the user. And user models are also used in the intelligent tutoring community. They're using them a lot too. So you can imagine sort of a math tutoring system. It would be a good idea if the tutoring system could remember which problems you got right, which problems you had problems with, so that it can then tailor the problems it gives you based on that information. So this idea of user model is used in that community a lot as well. So the hard part, though, here, of course, is figuring out how you actually populate these things. And there's also been discussion about, like, what does this thing look like? And, you know, the most basic or easiest way to think about what it looks like is just a text document that contains a bunch of terms. That's sort of the most simplest thing that you can imagine. But, of course, that's not very robust and will sort of get you into some problems when you think about how complex search actually is. But this has been a hard problem since people started talking about filtering. So figuring out how to get this information in there and also maintain the profile over time. So these are the major approaches that I wanted to tell you about. One approach is called explicit feedback, and then there's another called implicit feedback. And implicit feedback in particular is interesting because people have studied this a lot in a lot of different areas. You know, you can look in the data mining literature, you can look in the advertising literature, business literature, MIS literature, and you can find people talking about this. So it's a really popular thing to try to look at. And then the last thing here is people have started to use what's on a user's desktop as a source of information for populating these user models or profiles. And this can be information just from the person's file structure and the documents they have on their hard drive, like Microsoft Word documents or any other kind of document. Or it could also be if a person has an email application that's running on their hard drive or on their local machine, actually using that information as well to try to get an idea about what that person's interests are. I'm not going to talk as much about this. One is because I wanted to tell you all about TREC, and so I said, well, I have to sort of cut down on something. And I also haven't done as much research in that area, so I don't really have as many interesting things to tell you about using the user's desktop as a source of information. But it's there, and you can imagine some of the problems related to that, which is that there's a lot of stuff on your desktop. Some things are more important than others. It's really difficult to apply certain search techniques or indexing techniques to documents when the assumptions behind those indexing techniques aren't met, because you've got an email message versus a long document that is, you know, some sort of scholarly paper. So it's hard to sort of get a handle around those issues. So the explicit feedback, this is something that probably most everybody in here is familiar with. I experienced it when I was trying to figure out how to do animation on my slides, which is funny. But when we think about explicit feedback, in the IR literature, we often talk about it as term relevance feedback or relevance feedback. And that's a pretty important thing there, because it actually is, the assumption is that some human being is providing a relevance assessment, an indicator of providing information about what they think is relevant. And in IR, it's often done on terms, at the term level. And so what might happen is that the system may say, the user may enter a query, the system then says, well, here's some search results, but here are some really good terms. Select some of these terms and add them to your query. The user then can add these terms to their query and then rerun retrieval and get new search results. So that's typically how term relevance feedback works. And I'll just show you some examples here. This example here is from a study that we did, so this just is showing some related words a person could add to their query. This I grabbed from Amazon. This I grabbed from Netflix. And this I grabbed from trying to figure out if I knew animation. So was this information helpful? So presumably somewhere they're storing this information about the query that I just typed and whether this information here is actually relevant to that query. Here's another view. This is a view with the same terms, but then there are some sentences here. People in QA have also added, you know, allowed a person to select sentences that they thought were good to use for feedback. And this stuff is, you know, kind of all well and good. System-centered research, so that's research that doesn't think about users, has found that relevance feedback generally improves retrieval performance. So this is sort of accepted. And relevance feedback is probably one of the most researched topics in IR. And there's also something called pseudo-relevance feedback, which is where the system just automatically assumes that it's so wonderful that the top 10 documents, for instance, that it has retrieved for your query are absolutely relevant, and they will go in before it even shows you search results, extract key terms from those top 10 results, add those to your query, and then do retrieval again and show you those results. So there's even techniques that just assume that, you know, the top end documents are relevant. And again, as you've heard, that a lot of times this explicit feedback is used for query expansion. So you can imagine doing query expansion in a single search session, but you can also imagine the long-term possibilities of this kind of information. So getting information that you might store somewhere offline in a user profile, not just to help for with an immediate search. So the user-centered research, so these are studies that often look at the interfaces that are provided for people giving explicit feedback. Has sort of had mixed results. And part of the reason is because it's actually a hard problem. If you think about the examples I showed you, one piece of this is, how do you get those terms? That's a hard problem. How do you figure out what terms to show people to begin with? The second problem is, how do you present them to the person so that they make sense? So some research has said, well, you know, just showing people terms isn't really good because the terms are out of context and people really have a hard time making decisions about the usefulness of the terms. And then the other problem is, once the person has selected something, what do you do with that? So there's actually a really big, hard problem. And very few studies have actually tried to tackle all three of those major problems. Usually people are just looking at one slice of those. And that's why the results, I think, are typically mixed. So here are some other reasons why the results are typically mixed. So the terms are often not presented in context, so it's hard for people to understand what they mean. A lot of times the terms the system suggests are just weird. They don't make sense to a human. Why is this 1964 suggested? Why is the word, you know, ABC suggested? I don't know. So the quality of terms often impacts, people say, impacts the uptake of this. People often also say that users don't have the additional cognitive resources to sort of deal with trying to provide feedback at the same time as searching for documents. This is another very famous one, is sort of generally accepted that people just don't want to provide feedback. This is too much effort. And this is really funny because I'm actually a person, even though I think I've probably written this in a paper I wrote and published years ago, but now I feel that this isn't so true anymore, because people have no problem spending hours and hours of their time tagging documents, writing annotations, writing blogs. So people do seem to be more interested in sort of providing information. It's just trying to figure out how we leverage that in this context. And then, of course, this idea of the sustainability of this gathering information through explicit feedback techniques. Is this really going to work over a long period of time? Do we remind users every week to go and do this, check out their profile and make sure it's right? So I've done a lot of studies on explicit feedback, and I'm not going to tell you about some of those studies. What I wanted to tell you about is this sort of other look at trying to get more information from human beings. And I'm going to tell you about this study I did with a couple of people on query elicitation. And so we know that, in general, people pose really short queries to web search engines, and typically this is on the order of 2.5 words or something. And so what people generally have thought and found in the information retrieval literature, there's been a lot of discussion about people's information needs and how people really have a hard time articulating their information needs, that a lot of times you're actually searching for something that you don't already know, otherwise you wouldn't be searching for it, so how are you supposed to actually come up with a good query? So there's been a lot of research on that. And then you can also think of this idea that traditional search interfaces like Google or Yahoo actually encourage people to write short queries. And in fact, I would contend, although I do not work for any of these companies, that they want you to, because if you write a long query, you're not going to get anything, right? Everything is optimized for these short queries now, so that's, of course, what they want you to type and give to them. But what we know in IR, and even if we look at traditional library science literature, is that people actually can say more about what their interests are than the 2.5 words. For some reason, when people are given a short query box, they just sort of only type in two or three things, and that's it, even though they may know more stuff about what it is they're looking for, why they're looking for it. So they do know some things that could potentially be useful in retrieval. And there's this idea of this polyrepresentative extraction of information. So this is an idea by Peter Ingerson, and he suggests that you try to get as many different pieces of evidence from the person about what their interests are, you also get many different representations from the collection about what's in there. So and you also apply many different retrieval strategies. So there's sort of polyrepresentation at multiple levels, at the user level, at the retrieval algorithm level, as well as at the indexing level.
So this is more than just the faceted search that Jimmy was mentioning.
Right, I would say this is more, because it's not quite that structured. And in fact, the stuff I'm going to show you is based on what used to happen. I don't know if it happens anymore. What used to happen in a reference interview, where a person would go in and speak with a reference librarian, and the reference librarians are actually trained to extract and elicit particular pieces of information from the users, from the patrons. They're trained to ask particular questions. So there is some similarities in what he was saying towards the end, but it's what we do here is a little bit different than the PICO. So the other thing to know is that research has actually demonstrated that there's a positive relationship between query length and retrieval performance, and precision in particular. And this is in batch mode studies. Again, I know all of you are thinking about your experiences with Google, and you're thinking, no way, but this is true in IR in general. This has been demonstrated quite a few times in closed collections in particular. And so the other thing here that was motivating this piece of research is that we know that people have a hard time, sometimes have a hard time articulating what they're interested in, but people also having a hard time with this term relevance feedback. So what we thought we would do is actually try to back up at the very first point where the person enters the system and get a better understanding of what their interests are at that point. Because the other funny thing with term relevance feedback is that these terms that are suggested are based on the first retrieval results. And if the person's query is not any good, then the first retrieval results are unlikely to be good, and therefore the terms that are extracted may not be very good either. So this sort of goes back to square one. So what we did is we had a bunch of users and we basically gave them this form to type in their query instead of just a little query box. And I have been involved in some other research where we had all we did, this is a very small thing, is we increased the size of the query box. We had like a traditional query box and then we made it a lot bigger and it had actually several rows of text you could provide. And we found that people provided longer queries with a bigger box. And that's some very low-level basic thing, but that's what we found in our results. So there is something to this. You know, you see this box, you want to fill it, and you can only fit a couple of words in there, and then you're done. So we ask these questions, and these are questions that people typically that people ask in reference interviews. And the stuff in blue here is just for your use. The users didn't see this, but this is just so you can think about that for the next slide. So this is what we found. We actually found that this is the length of people's baseline queries, and these queries actually were a little bit longer than average. And part of the reason for that is, if you think back to that topic I showed you, the Trek topic, the people involved in this study were actually involved in a Trek project, and we took the title of their query and the description and made queries out of it. So we didn't just use the first title, because the title is usually like two or three words, but we wanted to use the title plus description, because in Trek that generally performs better than title only queries. And so we didn't want to have like a baseline that was really awful. So that's why that number is a little bit higher than what you might be used to seeing. So with that second question we asked, people's responses were about 16 words long. And these are unique words. With respect to Q3, we got about 11 words. And then down here, keywords was pretty low. And this is, again, very similar to this explicit feedback table. So I'm going to show you the performance of these things. But the other thing I wanted to tell you about, this is sort of a traditional way of doing things at Trek, is that you actually have these things called runs. And a run is your retrieval results for a set of topics. In this case, we're going to be dealing with 50 topics, which is what you're usually dealing with. So these statistics are actually over, they're run level statistics. It's the map thing I showed you before, and this is called a run, so you submit these things. We had baseline, we had several different pseudo-relevance feedback runs, because if we're not doing better than that, then why even bother people to begin with? So we just used the top 5 terms, 10 terms, 20 terms, and 50 terms. And then we had runs where we added the Q2 information to the baseline, and then the information from these other ones to the baseline. And then we did a big combination we did various combinations. And this was sort of the big kahuna, 2, 3, and 4 all together. So this is what we found. This shows you the baseline value, the mean average precision. And then this shows you our best one, which happened to be when we combined all that information together. So all this evidence that we collected in these various different ways seemed to really improve retrieval performance in this setting. And again, this is a retrieval on a closed corpus of newswire documents, and I'm not claiming that, of course, this is going to be the same as what you would see in the web, especially with the way the web works today.
Mm-hmm. When you added in the information from Q2, 3, and 4, and I think what you say is absolutely right, because when people ask questions of other people, they put in why they want the information and what the background is. Did you add in all the words, or did you remove the stop words?
We removed the stop words. I don't think we did any stemming.
And you waited any waiting on the words?
Here we didn't do any waiting on the words. And what we found, actually, you can see these pseudo runs didn't do so well. And from, I think, this Q2 is really what added really a lot of unique information. From this point onward, these results on a pairwise t-test with here and here, and here and here and here, those are all statistically significant. So Q2 was really the thing that was like the boost that gave us more information. So with this data, we also just wanted to look at the relationship between query length and performance when we had things that were generated by users, because the previous studies were just cases where people were doing pseudo-relevance feedback. And we found this very beautiful relationship, which you never find in research that I do, I can tell you that. So this is jumping around to see this, which just shows you that you know, there is in fact just a linear relationship between query length and mean average precision. And that is, we did a regression analysis, so that's the formula that you get for that. So it is the case that getting more information from people is a good thing, not only just for initial retrieval, but it can potentially also be a good thing if you're trying to collect information that you're going to use in a model over time.
What do you do with the query? I mean, is it the Boolean library or before a conjunction or what?
No, we use something called Lemur, which is an IR toolkit that's very standard for people to use. It was developed at CMU and UMass, and actually Injury is a model that you can get with it.
It's the same thing I use, essentially.
Yeah, and we're using actually a probabilistic retrieval model. And I should say this, because I was thinking about all these different models that some of us have been telling you about. Oh, the probabilistic and the vector space, and then there's the language modeling. Fernando, who is here for several months, actually knows all about this stuff. And so if people are really interested in really getting the nitty-gritty on these retrieval models, I'm sure he could probably tell you some good stuff about that. But this is a probabilistic retrieval model. In fact, we used OCopy.
Mm-hmm. Is there a point where you have too much precision when you're doing these queries? I'm just like thinking of like my search or something on Google, right? If I put in too much information, then I ruin it.
Well, in this data, you see that it doesn't drop off. And so basically, you're getting more, you're getting better with respect to this map value. Again, I have no idea how the Google search algorithm works because I don't work there, but it's definitely optimized for short queries. I feel pretty confident saying that. And so, yeah, with there, I think you would see probably a huge drop off even if you entered something like an 8-word query. I'm not sure. I haven't tried that, but yeah, on the web, it's a little bit different. And actually, it's kind of interesting because what's happened in the IR community is that on the web, the majority of tasks that people are looking for on the web are like these kind of navigation tasks or sort of quick answer finding tasks. You know, what time does the movie start? What's the weather? Where is this homepage? This kind of stuff. And they're optimized for those kind of tasks. And because of that, those kind of tasks in the IR community have really started to become the focus. And people are forgetting about these classical IR tasks, like, you know, the scholar who's trying to find documents about a particular topic. Oh, that's not sexy. Nobody wants to study that anymore. People want to study this really high precision oriented search. And that also is reflected in the kind of measures that people are developing and choosing to use in their evaluation reports. So there's a measure called mean reciprocal rank, which is really focused on, is that first thing relevant in that list? We don't care about recall. We don't care about any of that stuff. We care about optimizing precision. So this kind of high precision and specific kind of task focus of search engines have definitely sort of drizzled out into the general community, where people, again, are kind of focused on particular tasks. So I think that these are some of the things that we can say about these findings. Again, I would say with the caveat, as you all know, is that this was, again, a laboratory experiment on a closed collection of documents. And so I'm not claiming here any generalizability to the web, but I do think that there's some interesting findings here that might inform how we go about doing user modeling in particular and collecting information from people.
It's really interesting because, as Jimmy was noted, physicians are using Google to retrieve information. They're not just using PubMed. And you know, you do get these very complex questions, and I think you're absolutely right that the Google is designed for these short queries, because I've given up trying to put long queries. But I mean, you do have another community, like medics looking for information, and there are articles talking about how often this is being used, and yet you're right that it's just the wrong thing for that kind of, because then the task is different.
The task is a precision-based task, and these medical people obviously probably aren't I mean, they're probably interested in precision, as Jimmy said, but recall is also important. And it's one thing to know that there are 1,000 relevant documents and you see maybe 100 of them, but it's a different thing if there are 1,000 and you only see 5 of them. And they're in the first top 5 positions, so that's really great for you, but it's these things mean different things.
So I think Google is optimized for short queries because people don't want to type it in. And also, a lot of people use search engines as a navigational tool. But if they don't want to go and type in Amazon.com, they go to Google, they type Amazon, it comes up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know if we should find fault for with Google because they are optimizing for short queries. They're obviously, you know, looking at what their customers want.
Well, yes. Are they? Or have they? I mean, there's this idea of like technological determinism as well, which is that the system determines the behavior, right? You do things a particular way because that's how the system supports it. And so I'm not saying that this is the right answer, but it is the case that systems control the way we think about and solve problems. Information systems do. And it may be that, you know, everybody's doing exactly what they really want you to do as opposed to them doing it for what users are doing. But it is the case, too, as Bonnie mentioned before, a student at our school gave a presentation on Friday on QA, or Yahoo Answers, which is like this social QA system. And she was showing some examples of questions that people were typing. And it's very funny because they type a question, and then they provide this paragraph description about what their purpose is, what their task is. And they'd never do that if they thought they were just communicating to a system. But since they know they're actually communicating so that another human being will read it, they provide all this extra information, which helps in trying to answer the question.
So another site like that is the what's called National Library of Health in the UK, where physicians can type in questions and people will answer the questions and post them on the site. Mm-hmm. And they have the same character. They explain why they're asking the question before they actually ask the question.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, it is the case too that a lot of queries are navigational type queries, these queries that can be addressed by where people want high precision because there's only one answer or there's just one response. Maybe it's low stakes kind of searching, consequences aren't high. So yeah, there, you know, it's a complex issue, but you could think about it from both sides, I think.
And I think like some of the user studies that Google has done, I was lucky enough to attend one of the talks by Daniel Russell, who has done a lot of the user in interfaces for them. So for example, people don't read, you know, they just it's like an F shape. You read the first hit, the second hit is only half part, you know, and that's it. You give up and you change your query. And the longer your query is, the more time you spend because you feel like you have something invested in the query. So, you know, it's a matter of chicken or egg, right? Which one comes
right
first?
And there is this kind of phishing strategy, you know, type in something, see what we get, refine.
Right.
So, yeah, it's interesting and really complex. So I wanted to say something about implicit feedback. So this is actually, so the other ways we're talking about people physically, but explicitly doing something to provide feedback. This is actually the idea of watching what a person does over time and inferring, based on those behaviors, what that person's interests are. And so some of the key things that people have studied have been this idea, well, these are sort of classes. You can imagine examine, so select. This is called click-through, and you may have heard about this yesterday. So here a person has just selected something, so therefore we can assume it's relevant, maybe. Viewing, listening, scrolling, if you do a find, in an article, or you can think about queries as evidence that you could gather if you were interested in doing modeling where you wouldn't have to bother a person because they already do this. And then you could think of cumulative measures, so number of times a person viewed a document. So a view is just binary. Yes, the person, well, not binary, but it's continuous in that a person maybe viewed it one time, viewed it 10 times in the week. What's the difference in terms of relevance?
Relevance or age of the queryer.
Age of the queryer. Yeah. The other one I think I must have forgotten in here is something called display time, which I'll tell you about. So people have actually studied the length of time a person has displayed a document in their browser as an indicator of relevance. And the idea is that the longer it's displayed, the more likely There's a whole class of retention behaviors, there's reference behaviors, and then there's annotate and create behaviors. And the list here is sort of is growing as we imagine more and more technologies that support this kind of behavior. And so basically what we're doing here is watching things that are the byproduct of searching. So again, we have this idea that people are unwilling to provide feedback, so this seems like a good thing to do, and that people are unlikely to maintain these profiles. And the big thing is that all this information is being accumulated, and you can think about all the things that you select while you're online. In that whole mess of stuff, some of that, the good documents are in there. It's just a matter of trying to figure out how we go in and identify those good documents. So if you think of every single thing that you look at, some of that's good, some of that's relevant. I don't know what percentage of it is, but some of it is. So research has found in general, and this is not sort of my, I don't believe these things strongly, so I'm just kind of telling you what research has found, that there's a positive correlation between selection and relevance. And search engines in particular, sort of the study du jour at SIGIR this year and last year are studies that search engine companies have done where they do log analysis and they have 50 million records and they basically go in and look at people's selection behavior. And so search engines, of course, whenever you go use them, they collect your query, they collect the first page of search results and any search results pages that you see, and they also collect the first thing that you click on from those search results. So they actually have all that information from you. And that's just what I know that they collect. They may collect other things as well. So there's been a lot of studies that looked at that. And then also some studies that have found that there's a positive relationship between display time and relevance. But the problematic things about these studies have been that most of these things are based on incomplete data. So again, what a search engine gets is kind of incomplete if you think about all the users' behaviors. And they're also based on sort of a general model of what people are doing. And I'll remind you that the idea is personalization, right? So we would think in personalization that we actually want to get a little bit more beyond the general because we're not doing one size fits all. The other thing that this research has not really dealt with very well is that this idea that contextual variables affect a person's behavior. So you can imagine when you're searching for news articles, you probably do one thing, and that's different than when you go look for weather, and that's different than when you're looking for papers about a scholarly topic, and that's different from when you're, you know, communicating with people through some sort of chat group. So behaviors vary according to what people are trying to accomplish. And also you can imagine your behavior may change according to how much you know about the topic already. We were talking, I think, maybe in Jimmy's talk about this idea of users, and a user, maybe this was 2 days ago, a user may be an expert in one topic, but not an expert in another topic. And so the person's behaviors are likely to change to reflect this.
I just have a comment, you know, since you're talking about personalization, there's a search engine started by the inventor of the voicemail. It's called ChaCha.
Mm-hmm.
And what he does is as soon as you type a query, you can have a user-guided search that's directed to an expert somewhere around, and there are claims of at least 10,000 or so. And they help guide the search by expanding your query and so on. And it seems that users are more willing to engage with a human and giving relevance feedback for their results rather than with a computer, and also in expanding their query beyond two words. So it seems like a very non-conventional way to include the user feedback in the search. And as far as I've seen, it works as good as Google or, you know, perhaps better.
Mm-hmm.
Just a comment.
Yeah. Mark was telling us about that search engine because it's the person's in Indiana.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
They have heavy investments from Jeff Bezos.
Mm-hmm. So the study that I want to tell you about quickly is sort of actually a really big study that I did, and I wanted to look at the relationship between these behaviors and relevance, and so I'll tell you what behaviors I was looking at, and then also context. And one goal of this study was actually also to develop a method for studying these things. And so I looked at these studies that had studied implicit feedback and was kind of unsatisfied with how people went about studying implicit feedback because usually they were collecting data from a server, and server-side data, especially when you're talking about things like display time and printing and saving, which you can't even get at the server, is not as accurate as the kind of data you could get on a client machine, because a client machine you can get a lot more accurate data. And I was also interested in doing this over a long period of time to really zero in on some individuals. And so basically what I did was 7 case studies. I had 7 people, and the results I show you, I'm not averaging over all 7 people because there's plenty of data for each individual, as you'll see in a second. So I just wanted to look at each one of those in this context of this idea of personalization. I did this, did this in the wild, and I did it for 14 weeks. And the good thing about this is how did I get people to let me do this? How did I get people to participate? Because the people that were participating had to let me log every single thing that they did for 14 weeks. So I actually had a software application on their laptop that logged everything, all their documents and everything else. And then there was also an application I was running, a proxy server. And what the proxy server allowed me to do is actually keep a hard copy of every page that they viewed during that 14-week period. So I actually created this gigantic collection of data. And you might be thinking, were these people censoring themselves? And my response to you is, at least one of them was not. But in exchange for doing this, I sort of waved new laptops and printers in front of them. And in case you guys have any sort of ethical questions, I actually am on the institutional review board for my university, and so I am a person who is like very, very hyper aware of research ethics. And so all of the things I tell you were done with the, attention to detail, attention to this kind of detail anyway.
Excuse me. So this 14 weeks is something to do with these 7 students, or it's more like just a period of 1 semester?
It ended up being a semester because the study that I wanted, while studying these students, the semester kind of made sense as a unit to study them. The idea was that they would have started some new activities, finished some activities, and then also would have had some ongoing activities, and so that's why it was selected.
Okay.
The other thing is that I was actually doing this entire study myself, and so, that was what 14 weeks of my life was just spent administering this experiment. They were PhD. None of them were from information science. They were all, they're actually mixed. I had some humanities people, some hard science people, some engineers. So what did I collect? So I told you I collected actually a hard copy of everything that they looked at, but these are the behaviors I collected and extracted from my logs. I had display time for every document they viewed. I had printing and saving behavior, and I also had bookmarking, which isn't here. I also asked them to judge the relevance, and I called it usefulness, of all the documents that they viewed, a subset of those, I should say, and I'll tell you how I made that selection in a second. And then I considered this kind of stuff context, and so I broke context up into thinking about what they were trying to do from a task and topic standpoint, and you can think about this as what's called an information need. And then for each one of these variables, I had several other variables that could be used to characterize them. So a person's familiarity with the topic, how long they were interested in the topic. For task, are you almost finished or are you just starting? How often do you do this? So I collected this kind of information. So for every single document in my collection, I had all this data associated with it.
In this case, a document basically means that all the web pages are also including something like a PDF file associated with the web pages. Also.
It would have been a PDF or an HTML document with basically the objects that I was looking at.
So this is all web browser oriented then, all internet type documents?
Yes, these were internet type documents that I showed them. Although I had all their other documents, I could have showed them, but I didn't.
And so, so when you were talking about logging all the behavior, I was worried maybe you were doing screenshots or like keystroke capturing, or this is really all your collecting.
No, I logged every single thing that they did, so I have all keystrokes.
Okay.
There's not screen
Absolutely.
Capture. It's just a logger that was running in the background every mm-hmm. time their computer was on, and it was collecting information. And I also collected, I should say, this Fernando comes into play here as well. It pops up into the presentation many times. He shared with me an application he wrote, which went in and basically was called a file sniffer, and it went in and audited what was on the person's hard drive, so it actually could copy all of the Microsoft Word documents or Excel files and things like that. So I collected that data, but I never did anything with it because I had enough data here.
And they weren't
stuff over to this the laptop. There were a couple of people who were engineers and who worked on another machine while they were at their office, so to speak. So maybe they had running special hardware. So I'm not going to claim that this is a 100% complete picture of every single thing the person ever did for 14 weeks using a computer, but it's, again, the data I'll show you in a second, you'll probably say, well, that's a pretty good amount of data that you actually capture. So.
So did student knew you are monitoring?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes.
So that basically means that maybe they are behaving differently.
Well, I mentioned before that you could think that, but actually one person looked at pornography all the time, and it actually was a big pain for me because I wasn't interested in getting them to evaluate pornography pages. You know, I could do personalization in that context, but I wasn't interested in it. So there's some evidence that people were looking for a wide variety of topics about censoring.
Oh.
But again, I can't claim that they this was
okay.
All their
I know some.
So for that data you're talking about on the right, are you saying you went through with them afterwards through every single web page? You interviewed people about what their needs were?
I'll show you what the procedure was in just a second. But these were, suffice to say, these were actually labeled. This is like labeled data. Somebody would say, oh, I'm doing this, or oh, I'm doing that. So this varied. This actually, these things were elicited using scales. So this actually ended up being numeric data, like 1 to 7 point scales. So what happened in the study is this stuff was running all the time, and at the start of the study, I sort of asked people, what kinds of things are you working on, and asked them to identify their task and topics, assuming that this would change and that they probably weren't going to be able to do this in this one instance, and so I'll show you what I did to address that. And then I also got them to evaluate those tasks and topics. And so each week of the study, each person met with me for 1 hour, and they looked at their, what I call context. They did the context evaluation again, and then they also did document evaluations. And so these were evaluations on pages that they viewed during this period of time. And so we did this for 14 weeks. And I interviewed them at the end and collected some other kinds of data as well about the method. But I didn't show people every single document that they viewed during a 1 week period, because of course you can imagine that's going to be one person sitting there evaluating 500 documents, but I actually had to make some sort of random selection of documents after I went in and weeded out things that I knew, like a cascading style sheet was logged at the logger or something like that I knew that doesn't make sense to ask them about. So this just shows you the interface that I used where subjects did the evaluations. And so I populated these windows here with the tasks and topics that each subject had identified. So for subject, this is subject two. Those were subject two's tasks, subject two's topics, and they could add a new task and topic as they started the evaluations, because they might say, oh yeah, this was about this thing I was trying to do, or that thing. But they classified each document according to these tasks and topics, and then I got some usefulness data here, and then their confidence in their rating of the document. This just shows you how much data was elicited from these subjects. And so you can see that there's a huge amount of data. Subject one actually evaluated 870 documents. So I have all that data for 870 documents just for that one subject. And then you can see for other people, there was a big variety. This person in particular didn't use the internet that much. She mostly used it for email, so there wasn't as many documents in her collection. And then you can also get an idea of the range of tasks and topics that people identified. So again, the goal here was not to sort of average over all seven people, but actually look at creating things that were personalized to the individual.
Subject one, the pornography.
Yes, absolutely.
Because they all
Yeah, this person
they all link to each other and they pop up all kinds of stuff. And
yeah, he was this was the pornography person. And I'm trying to remember what this person just used a computer an awful lot to do shopping and stuff like that. And this person wrote reviews for Amazon a lot, and so he had all of these different pages. And I should say URLs requested, anytime a person goes to the Google homepage, for instance, that would make a record in my log. And so I didn't ask people to evaluate the usefulness of the Google homepage and to classify it according to task and topic. But those are items that you can imagine actually make up this kind of figure here.
Did you record how much time they spent on the net?
I have that information, total time. I actually computed the amount of time they spent per page. And so I could have computed that as well, but I didn't.
You didn't anything interesting there? I'm just curious.
So
I have no idea how people might react depending upon the time they spent.
Well, that would be, and that's something that's really funny that happened when people were evaluating the pages. They were like, I looked at that. I spent all the time doing this. And then some of them were working on their dissertation, and one of them, he was actually telling me about the stuff he was looking at. He said, you know, I was doing my comps, and then as soon as I finished my comps, there's like this blast of shopping that he does. You know, so he's like not doing it. He's goofing off for a few days because he just finished this really intellectually demanding task. And so people were really reflective about how they had been spending their time during those evaluations, but I didn't actually show them this is your total time. That data is in there, and like I said, as you can imagine, there's a ton of data here. And so I only looked at a little bit of it. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, you said this, but did they evaluate each week? Did they meet with you and then you gave them a random sort of document? Did they evaluate or just at the end?
Every week. Yeah. So it was pretty a big commitment on their part to be in the study. So I see that I'm basically out of time, and of course I have lots more slides to show you. But what I want to do is just sort of jump to the summary of the findings here from this study. What I found was that most display times were very low, and actually you can look at this. Oops, this is just this is basically what the distribution of display time looks like for pretty much any of these studies. This is a common way this looks. Most pages are only displayed for a really short period of time, and then there's a really long tail here. And I actually cleaned this up by looking at things that were outliers. So there, you know, may have been something over here that was like 40 minutes or 1 hour where a person went off to get coffee or something. The other thing is that most usefulness ratings were really high. And so this actually was a problem for me because I didn't anticipate this, but people were saying, oh, this is useful, this is useful, this is useful. And you can think about usefulness and relevance. It's really not ambiguous, but it's a really broad kind of concept and term. And so when you think about if you're doing your own web searching, and I'll show you an example in a second, you know, you can think about, yeah, the weather report, that's useful. Oh, here's some information about this disease I have, that's useful. Oh, here's a paper that I really need to read for this paper I'm writing, that's useful. But those things are kind of useful at different levels. So that's sort of a problematic thing about this. And then I actually found no direct relationship between display time and usefulness. And so that was sort of an interesting thing. What I did find was that there was a main effect for display time when we, according to task and to topic, and also to a person's familiarity. So those kind of contextual attributes actually seem to be the most important attributes in trying to make sense of a person's behavior. And again, the idea here is that we want to figure out how we can use this behavior as indicators of evidence so that we can build these models. But in order to do that, we have to figure out how the behavior can actually be used. And one of the major findings here is that we actually need to think about task. And in fact, task is a really important thing in terms of trying to make better sense of this display time data. So I'm just going to buzz through some of these other things. To show you this slide, which is a big problem about what we're modeling. And that example I just gave you sort of speaks to this, is like, does one click really equal relevance? Are we modeling something else? What is this? And here are some web pages you could imagine somebody finds all highly useful. A definition, yes, that's relevant. That's exactly what I wanted, a definition for relevance. Here's a recipe for peanut butter cookies. It's exactly what I wanted. That's actually a really good recipe. Here's the weather forecast. And then again, here you have this, and you might say, well, this is relevant. But then you can think about, well, why is this relevant? Oh, it's from the CDC, so I know that they're authoritative. And you can think about all these different criteria that people sort of times incorporate into their relevance assessments. And then things get to be a little bit different. The other thing is page structure. So this is what I was telling Bonnie, that's a little bit like what she was talking about. is that some behaviors are more or less likely to occur on some types of pages. So you can imagine that for some pages, like a Google homepage, you're going to see somebody type a query and hit the search button because that's what they do on that page. For a search results page, you may see that page visited lots of times, not because it's so great, but maybe because it's not so good and the person's having to go through systematically and click on every single result and having to keep going back. So this actually, you can think about the page structure encouraging or inhibiting certain behaviors, and also think about not all pages are equally as useful for modeling a person's interest. So again, the Google homepage, it's not really anything unique there, except for maybe that query the person types. So again, you can think of the kind of behaviors you would see here. Here you'd see maybe a lot of clicking, maybe some querying. Here, there's some clicking that you could do, but probably more reading. Down here, there's no links on this page, so you're probably not going to see any clicking, so why bother to even observe clicking, because it's not going to occur. So I'm going to end here and just sort of leave this slide up here so you can think about the big thing about this implicit feedback and behaviors is that it's really exciting right now because people are developing all sorts of new features and systems. And as we develop these new features and systems and even interaction styles, you can think about the new opportunities these things introduce for collecting implicit feedback, new kinds of implicit feedback. So we can think about collaborative search features and all kinds of data that we can get that way, query recommender systems, which is another topic that I'm interested in, but is another place where you can get information. Now systems are starting to support more of the search process, so not just finding documents, but saving them and organizing them, coming back to them later, supporting what's called exploratory search. So there are all kinds of features that allow a person to do those things. Those things may have information for us. QA systems, which is a thing that I've spent some time evaluating, QA systems have a lot of different kinds of interaction techniques that are applied. So those also introduce new possibilities for feedback. And then we haven't really done much with negative feedback, so that's another big area. And then the last thing, which I'm hoping to get some money to look at, is actually using physiological data. So things like heart rate, sweating. So yes, picture this person. This person in this lab with all these devices hooked up to them. But it's going to be done. So that's another place. So
no, please.
Anyway, I thank you for your time, and I'm sorry I went over a little bit.